By listening to the Conscious Fertility Podcast, you agree to not use this podcast as medical advice to treat any medical condition in either yourself or others. Consult your own physician or healthcare provider for any medical issues that you may be having. This entire disclaimer also applies to any guests or contributors to the podcast. Welcome to Conscious Fertility, the show that listens to all of your fertility questions so that you can move from fear and suffering to peace of mind and joy. My name is Lauren Brown. I'm a doctor of traditional Chinese medicine and a clinical hypnotherapist. I'm on a mission to explore all the paths to peak fertility and joyful living. It's time to learn how to be and receive so that you can create life on purpose.
I want to welcome you to another episode of the Conscious Fertility Podcast. And this one is one of those fertility-focused ones. I'm with Dr. Lyndon Chang. He's the medical director of Hanabusa IVF in San Diego. And he's a pioneer in the field of minimal stimulation, also the mini IVF in the States. And he specializes in a holistic approach, which we're going to find out what that means to him when it comes to fertility, using low stimulation IVF protocols. And I invited Dr. Chang to have this discussion on our podcast because a large part of our population have been diagnosed with diminished ovarian reserve or advanced maternal age. And when I started asking my patients and asking my colleagues, they said, you got to talk to Dr. Chang because he's helped facilitate live births with a lot of patients ranging between the ages of 45 to 49. He's had live births with patients with FSH between 20 and 166, conceiving through IVF using their own eggs. So Dr. Chang, welcome to the Conscious Fertility Podcast.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
And I think it's Mark Sklar, my acupuncture colleague, that I also put you on the radar for me. So you mentioned that you kind of have a little bit of a holistic approach. Is Mark Sklar part of your holistic approach? Tell me what that means for you, and then we'll jump into mini IVF and more. But what is a holistic approach from your perspective?
The holistic approach to it is looking at each patient as a total person, as opposed to just focusing on the fertility, because so much of what happens outside can impact what's happening inside your body. So just an example, woman under a great deal of stress, studying a lot, working a lot, it's going to suppress that pituitary of theirs. They're not going to make enough FSH, follicle-stimulating hormone. Their eggs are not going to grow well. If their eggs don't grow well, they're not going to produce good eggs to fertilize. They're not going to ovulate very well. They're not going to get pregnant. So you can't just focus on, you know, we're just going to get the eggs out. We're going to get the sperm to the egg. There are many, many aspects to this. And this is where, when I think of holistic, I think of, I guess it's more in my situation of individualizing the case person to person, as opposed to lumping them into this one group of patients who are having difficulty getting pregnant.
Well, you know, it's nice to hear you say this because you basically are sharing the principles of Chinese medicine, where they say that we don't treat the disease. So infertility, we treat the individual, and that each individual you got to look at in a unique way. So it's refreshing to hear somebody who's practicing an IVF clinic, a reproductive endocrinologist, have this approach. And we're seeing more and more of the data coming out, how stress can interfere with your fertility, how diet and the microbiome can affect your fertility. So it's nice that you have a systemic, holistic approach. Now, I really wanted to hear more about this patient population, like the women in their late 30s and 40s, or those who've been diagnosed with diminished ovarian reserve. And I hear this term mini IVF thrown around a lot. And talking to colleagues, they directed me to you because they said, not all mini IVFs are the same. And that this is kind of one of the things that you're, I would say you specialize in or you have a focus in. So maybe we can start with differentiating, or what is mini IVF and how is it different from what we would call traditional IVF?
I guess you have to kind of clarify the terms a little bit. I think of, if you're going to contrast it to traditional IVF, you should use the term minimal stimulation. And minimal stimulation is exactly what it sounds like. You're using less stimulation. You're using less stimulation medication opposed to a traditional high stimulation protocol. And that's what we really should be thinking about when we're talking about traditional IVF. This is a high stimulation protocol. You're using hundreds, thousands of units of these injections of FSH are being produced and you're trying to stimulate the eggs, as many eggs as possible, and then you're crossing your fingers and praying that one of those eggs is ideal. In minimal stimulation, one of the fundamental principles of minimal stimulation is that the natural egg that your body produces every month is the ideal egg that's been recruited by your body. Now, and that would be a natural cycle. We do have natural IVFs where you do nothing, but you just wait for that egg to come out and try to capture it with our retrieval needle. With minimal stimulation, with IVF in general, the idea would be for women at certain stages of their life, you can make the process more efficient. Instead of one egg being one baby, women in certain stages of their life can actually have multiple eggs resulting in more than one baby. And could you make the whole process a little bit more efficient? A woman in her 20s, I've seen 10, 12, 15 eggs result in totally normal, healthy, well, not babies, but embryos that potentially could be healthy babies after testing. A woman in her 40s will rarely ever make more than one healthy embryo. So what you do with minimal stimulation, the concept behind it is when you are stimulating, the first egg that you produce is the best, second egg is second best, and you can stimulate to the point where you can optimize a patient cycle, where in a patient who's in her 40s, you know that there's only going to be one ideal egg in any given cycle. There's no need to try to stimulate for 13, 14, 15 eggs. If you want to hedge, you can stimulate for 3 or 4 eggs, and that should be all the eggs that are necessary to optimize your chances for that cycle. So with minimal stimulation, it's literally just using less medications to try to accomplish the same results in a certain situation. When you're talking about mini IVF, you're talking about a very specific protocol that came out of the Kado's Ladies Clinic in Tokyo, Japan. This is where a lot of this work came from. And with mini IVF, it's a protocol that involved reducing the amount of injections to something pretty much every other day. And how you're going about doing this is you're using an oral medication called Clomid to stimulate the pituitary to have your body help stimulate along with this. Clomid itself will probably produce maybe 2, sometimes 3 eggs to grow. Although it's not unusual, it can even be more. I've had one patient that came to me relatively young. She was in her mid-30s, failed multiple IVF high stimulation cycles in Massachusetts, came to me. I did a protocol where it was just oral medications. He produced 6 eggs, and 3 of them ended up being perfectly healthy, normal embryos. And she had a baby, and we still have 2 more that we're going to be hopefully transferring in the near future. But mini IVF is this particular protocol of oral medication and using injections to try to accomplish the same thing with higher doses. But it is a minimal stimulation protocol, but a particular minimal stimulation protocol.
And the reason behind that then, like so many clinics, if somebody comes in with diminished ovary reserve or in their 40s, they tend to want to give them a high dose to try and get as many eggs to that retrieval. So why not do it that way? Why are you suggesting let's just go and try and get 1 or 2 or 3 with a minimal stimulation? What happens when we really are aggressive and give high doses of meds? Does it impact the egg quality?
What's going to happen when most women age? And also we talk about those women whose ovaries prematurely age, the diminished ovarian reserve, is the number of eggs that are available for recruitment every month decreases. And with this lower amount of eggs, you have a smaller amount of eggs consuming that stimulation, that FSH that's being used. And what we need to think about in this whole process is FSH is what is making the eggs grow. It is the water, the fertilizer to your plants. It's the food for your eggs. We know that what plants need a certain degree of water and fertilizer, but we also know that, you know, after killing many plants, if you give plants too much water and fertilizer, you will actually harm them. You will destroy them. From a more microscopic perspective, there's receptors on these eggs that respond to FSH. But if you flood these eggs with too much FSH, they will just shut down. All those receptors will prevent the FSH from coming in. So they become desensitized. It's a very common situation where you see women, you'll hear patients, they're going with all these follicles, and then they get these high stimulation protocols and everything shuts down, and they're called non-responders. In this case, they're most likely overstimulated by the amount of medication. So another thing that we do with minimal stimulation, we avoid the overstimulation scenario. Now, what we like to do here, we like to think of it as optimizing your FSH, trying to optimize the amount of water and fertilizer that's kind of feeding your plants, your garden. And we do that by measuring the hormones. Specifically, we measure a hormone called FSH to try to optimize FSH so we can not only optimize the quality, but we're hoping we can also optimize the quantity of eggs in the cycle. And that will allow us to hedge a little bit in certain situations. But once again, when we talk about women in their 40s, there are and women with very high FSH, there are a lot of good studies from, we were talking about 15, 20 years ago, that show that there's really not any difference between a high stimulation cycle and no medication at all. The success rates are very, very similar. If anything, the natural cycles tend to start to get have higher success rates because, once again, many of these patients are just getting overstimulated by the treatments. You know, I just had a patient come in earlier who, you know, unfortunately, circumstances, she gets pregnant, but unfortunately lost the baby. In the process, there's no infertility here. So in a case like this, she's in her 40s, we're trying to help her get pregnant. Our job is not to mess up her eggs, which naturally she would get pregnant with. And that's what I think is a problem with a lot of IVF centers. They are actually ruining the eggs by their protocols as opposed to helping them.
And do you have data then, like, because you're saying or suggesting high stimulation for these older women, those that have fewer eggs are having poor results. As you said, it's could be negatively impacting that egg quality, therefore not getting those blastocysts. Is the data showing better results when you do the minimal stimulation then?
You know, what happens, if you notice with any studies with IVF, actually their IVF is not evidence-based. There's usually not enough power. There are not enough patients going through the process, although it seems like a lot of patients. There's not enough patients to say that certain protocols work. There's just the numbers. But there is data to show that mini IVF is comparable to high stimulation IVF. There are some studies that are showing higher levels of success from lower stimulation in these cases. Unfortunately, because the numbers are small, that these are not thousands that we can compare in a randomized blind control study, I don't have, you know, we can't say it's definitive. But you'll hear multiple anecdotal cases, observational studies that show, hey, look, women who are failing traditional IVF succeeding with low stimulation protocols in these cases of diminished ovarian reserve or the older patients.
I had questions. I wanted to go back to that. And then I want to ask more about your testing, what you do, the monitoring. But just talking about the data, I'm just thinking about patients listening that are, you know, 41, 42, maybe have had failed IVS. You mentioned that you've helped people 45 to 49. So oftentimes they're encouraged to do donor eggs if they want a parent because they've had unsuccessful IVFs and because of the age factor. Just what are you seeing though in your practice? Like, you know, if somebody comes at 44, is it 1 out of 1,000 or 1 out of 10? Like, I'm just wondering how much hope can we put into the minimal stim? So, or are you still recommending for this population donor egg is really the route to go? Or do you feel that this is a worthy type of IVF because you can get pregnant still with your own eggs from your clinical experience?
Yeah, good question. It doesn't guarantee anything, you know, because there's actually so many variables involved, you know, sperm quality, you know, mechanical issues associated with the body. So minimal stimulation doesn't guarantee anything. But when I look at the cycle, when I think of a person going to donor IVF, I'm thinking, well, this is a person that has exhausted all the options available to them. And what I find is that many patients are getting pushed in that direction without exploring other options other than this one high stimulation protocol at this one IVF center. Example, a patient just graduated from our program, was from Washington. Actually, she was not that old. She was only 39 at the time, 39 AMH 0.7, her baseline FSH is 27. She goes to an IVF center, standard protocol, 300 plus units of injections daily, no response. And the doctor says, hey, look, it looks like you need to go to egg donors. I mean, this was one cycle from one IVF center with one protocol. And, this was very premature. She comes to our center. We optimize her cycle. We didn't do a full-blown very mini. It was more of a moderate stimulation. But based on her FSH, we realized this person was getting too much medication. Every cycle, blastocyst, multiple euploid embryos, transferred her first. She became pregnant, is on her way to having a baby. We have a couple other embryos frozen. So, before going into egg donation, we should be thinking of egg donation as a last resort. We should be thinking, look, what is it? 70-year-old woman in Uganda 2 years ago, last year, just had a baby from egg donation. What is the rush into doing egg donation? There's a financial factor. There's a time and money factor in all this. And yes, there are going to be situations where you're exploring more IVF versus the cost of egg donation. It may make more sense to go egg donation, because if you use up your resources for your autologous and you're not successful, you may not have anything for egg donation. But then again, from an egg donation standpoint, look, once again, 70-year-old woman in Uganda, 74-year-old woman in India, you have time to explore those options.
I don't know if I want to be raising a baby at 70. So when you say you could do it, you're 70. I also think about the child too, right? So
sure.
I see what you're saying is there's an opportunity for some to have a baby with their own eggs, because that's what everybody's first choice is. And just from the donor egg cycle, we have an episode on this, and I just want to share, because we've brought up the donor egg, is there's many ways to parent. And I will share that I've been doing this for, at the time of this recording, 24 years, and I've never had a patient regret doing donor eggs. The only regret she has had is that she waited so long to do the donor eggs to meet this child. Right. So there's many ways to do it, and donor egg is definitely an option. There's a time and place, like you said, holistically, individually, what's your circumstances. But there are people that just mentally, spiritually, culturally are not going to do donor eggs. So here's another option. Like you said, you can't guarantee it, another option. Yeah. And so this,
especially when you talk about, like, there are, like you said, cultures, the Middle Eastern culture, the Muslim Islamic culture, the egg donation is not considered acceptable within the religion. They only have this option. And if the doctor's saying, look, we're not going to treat you unless you do egg donation, they have no options there.
Yeah. So it's another option. And the minimal stim, you talked about testing, and you talked about it's often done with oral medications. So one of the ovulation drugs you mentioned is Clomid. Does letrozole, would you guys use letrozole as well, or is it always Clomid for a minimal stim?
No, we use letrozole as well. If anything, I like to mix up. I do worry that when you use one medication too long, too often, you will have negative effects with it. We know with Clomid, even though it stimulates the ovaries pretty well, it can have negative effects on the uterine lining. The environment doesn't develop very well. So yeah, you can argue, well, I'm not going to do a fresh transfer, but at the same time, these metabolites do linger in the system. It's been found that some of the Clomid metabolites can linger for 6, 7, 8 months. And if you're planning to do a transfer 3 or 4 months later, you may still have negative effects with these medications. So I like to kind of change things up. Letrozole has its downside as well. Letrozole, how does it work? It artificially lowers your estradiol levels, a type of estrogen that we measure. But that is the estrogen that we measure to determine egg quality as well. So it's very hard, especially when I have these patients who are in their 40s, and we do worry about egg quality. If they're on letrozole, it's very hard for me to determine whether or not this is an egg worthwhile going forward with an egg retrieval. Because I'm in a situation in my vet practice where many times I have these patients who are only have one or two eggs for retrieval. I don't want to do an egg retrieval unless it's really worth their while, that we have an opportunity. On letrozole, it makes it very, very difficult. Although it doesn't have that impact on the negative lining, on creating a negative lining, which might be beneficial for someone who's thinking about doing like a fresh embryo transfer or transferring sooner than later.
So you can use either or, but it sounds like your preference often is Clomid, and it depends on lining issues. Okay. And then your testing. So most of the clinics I've experienced, they're looking at the kind of tracking the estradiols on their labs and ultrasound for size and quantity, how many follicles. And you said you're testing FSH. So would your protocol change based on, like, that woman that had an FSH? I think you shared one of your case studies in her 20s. Her FSH was already elevated in the 20s. Do you do anything to try and lower the FSH before you start a stim? Because your protocol is going to increase the FSH by giving them Clomid, and you're going to give them exogenous by FSH by injecting it. So just curious what you're looking for and how this, why it's important to be monitoring FSH and how it changes your approach while they're stimming.
So like I said, the FSH is your water. We'll think of it like water on your soil, and you're just trying to make sure you're not overwatering the soil. So a couple of things you bring up with a diminished ovarian reserve, high FSH, suppressing the FSH beforehand, because if the FSH is too high beforehand, the eggs are not going to grow. And that's an important thing to suppress and bring it down to a level that is more ideal for egg development. That's going to be somewhere in the 10, 20, 10-30 range. Anything in between, eggs tend to grow better.
Can you repeat that? Your FSH number was between what?
You'll hear 10-20, 10-25, 10-30. Once you get clearly over 30, the eggs really don't grow well. And that's at that point, I have what's called a suppression stimulation, where we're actually literally giving medications to suppress that FSH. We're giving birth control pills, estrogen, progesterone, antagonists to suppress the hormones, which will actually allow the eggs to grow, oddly enough.
Would priming do that as well, if you just give them like the androgel and estrogen?
And that is the purpose of priming in that situation, to try to bring that FSH down. Now, what will happen, though, is many times after the prime is done, the doctors will immediately start stimulating at that particular point. But there's going to be a slight rebound in the patient's FSH once you stop that prime. So that's where a lot of times the doctors are very too aggressive at the beginning when they start stimulating. What we do is we are looking at the hormonal response, and we're looking also at the follicular response. You know, until those follicles start growing and producing estrogen, that FSH is going to start going up. And if you're stimulating at that point, it's going to force the FSH to a level that it's going to overstimulate the eggs and everything shuts down. But one of the fundamental things that we do is essentially priming. Second part, you know, there is always a time between stopping the prime and starting the stimulation where you kind of let nature trying to equilibrate things, see what the follicles are doing. Until those follicles are present, your FSH is going to continue to go up. You know, the follicles have to be present. You can't just stimulate blindly like that. And then what you're doing along the way is you're testing the FSH to make sure that FSH is not going to go overly high or overly low. We're talking about overly high in most cases. But, you know, when you deal with patients with polycystic ovarian syndrome, you can actually see very low FSHs in these situations. And people do get over-suppressed by a lot of the medications.
So going back to this, if you prime or you're doing before the IVF, you're artificially suppressing the FSH by giving them things like birth control or estrogens. When they stop that prime, often, like you said, there's a rebound that it's going to start up again, and the brain's going to start producing lots of FSH if that was their history. So what happens if, because that's going to be common for a lot of them, like some of them, they're still quiet, and then you wait so much, and then you start to stimulate. And I'm asking if that's one scenario. If the scenario, like how long until you wait, because eventually it's going to come back online and they're going to produce their own FSH.
Right.
If it starts to produce and you're seeing this high FSH, do you go again to suppress? You got to keep suppressing until you get a low FSH?
You keep suppressing until you start to see the estrogen elevate, the follicles start to grow. Once the estrogen elevates, we know that FSH starts decreasing.
But won't the FSH have to be, you have the FSH is going to tell the follicles to grow, which is going to produce the estrogen. So aren't you going to have some elevated FSH then? Because you need the FSH to tell the ovaries to grow.
That's what you have to worry about, over suppression at the start of the cycle, which is a problem as well with a lot of centers. They arbitrarily start suppressing priming, and they over suppress their patients. And with that over suppression, nothing is growing, nothing is responding. Even with suppression, as long as the initial FSH is within a kind of a normalish range, eggs will grow. You know, eggs will grow on birth control pills. People do get pregnant on birth control pills, not because they missed the birth control pills, but because they tend to have high FSH, and the birth control pills lower that FSH to levels that are more ideal for egg development. One protocol that I found was kind of interesting. They do it in CHR, Dr. Gleischer Center in New York. They actually keep the patients on estrogen and stimulate on top of that. And it's kind of like driving with your parking brakes on. You're slamming your foot on the accelerator, but you have the parking brakes on, so everything is going smoothly. You know, my thought would be, is there really a need to have the parking brakes on? Why don't you just reduce the stimulation in a situation like that?
Right.
But that's a way they get away with being able to do a high stimulation protocol in a situation like this.
And when you're testing the FSH, because you're giving them, say in this case, Clomid, and you're giving them injectables, FSH derivatives, won't you have a high FSH when you do the blood test?
Well, we may not be able to do both, you know. Okay. And in some situations, so what you're aiming for is that window of FSH that you're comfortable with, you know, whether or not it's 15, 20, 25, somewhere in that ballpark. I know that I believe UCSF, a lot of times their goal was somewhere in the 25, 30 range. So the idea, once again, is you're just giving enough medication to get yourself into that range, you know, to let's just say a person, and a lot of this has to do with antral follicle count as well. How many eggs are there and how much FSH are they going to be able to use? I see a patient with four follicles at the beginning of the cycle. I know that I can't give probably much more than 25, 50, well, 50 units of Clomid. That's probably max what I can do, or 150, 225 units of injections. I may not even be able to do both, you know. And then in a situation like that is, you know, do you really need to do both? The primary thing of mini IVF is a cost issue. Can we use the oral medications to reduce the amount of injections that we need to do? Typically, I don't actually do a lot of mini IVF where we do this combination of oral and injections, because I want to be able to control the FSH a little bit better. And if I use an oral medication and depend on nature responding, nature is unpredictable sometimes. I know that if I give a certain amount of injections, I can see a certain increase in FSH. But if I give a pill, it can be sometimes unpredictable.
So in your practice, if you can describe kind of how you're doing it, how you're dealing with diminished ovarian reserve and your success, because we talked about the minimal stim compared to traditional, is the minimal stim was oral medication like Clomid or letrozole with some stims.
Oh, that's mini IVF. That's mini IVF.
Mini IVF. And then I think I heard that you kind of prefer for yourself, not the oral, but just giving them still minimal stimulation injectables, so you have a better sense to read how much FSH they're getting to the ovaries.
Exactly. So it looks like a traditional IVF cycle in some ways, but the dosages are 75% less, 80-90% less.
And I've heard from other REIs in on the podcast, and I'm just seeing if you subscribe to this and if there's data for this, that the high dose, and you talked about overwatering, or like if there's four follicles, you know, that's a lot for them to consume. They were suggesting that it impacts the FSH receptors, and basically you could have a good egg in this woman, say at 42, but if you, I think I've heard them use the word pound the ovaries with that much medication, you could take a good egg and make it not so good. And
that's my belief and my understanding. And that is you'll see a lot of this in Asia, and you'll see a lot of this in Europe, this belief and this idea. Not so much here in the United States, although they're starting to get around it. There's another center that opened up nearby in San Diego, part of the RMA network. They're called Pearl Mini because of the fact that they do believe in this lower stimulation protocol. And and it's slowly, I think people are going to accept, you know, finally get around to understanding that this actually might be a better way of treating patients with high FSH.
Why is it that this is not fully accepted then in your peers and your colleagues? Why is it for this group of advanced maternal age, aid quality, or diminished renal reserve that they're still doing what we're calling the conventional traditional IVF versus these mini IVFs?
Well, I think what happens is you have these doctors who are trained in this. This is all they're trained in. And then what happens is that it works. Let's just say it can work like 80% of the time for their general patient population. The doctors have, there's a big supply demand issue, as we realize that there's a lot of patients who need fertility care, but there's really not enough doctors. So the doctors are, you know, trying to do whatever is most efficient for them, what they know best. And they're really kind of not getting out of their comfort zone. Another thing is that there's been a kind of a battle between the minimal stimulation and the high stimulation group in this diminished ovarian reserve realm. And there's been some very vocal people that are supporting high stimulation protocols, and they're very anti-minimal stimulation. I think there's a little bit of politics involved as well. Okay. So I think, you know, unfortunately, you know, there's the supply demand, there's just not enough physicians. So it's hard for them to kind of broaden their knowledge base and their understanding of this. And that's unfortunately has limited the growth of other types of options in medicine.
And then clinically, your experience, once we get into the diminished ovarian reserve and advanced maternal age, there's only so many, let me say, good eggs that will turn into good blasts that turn into babies. So clinically, what's your experience since you're going to do the minimal stimulation IVF or a mini IVF? Do they have to do a few to get to that? Because you're not pulling out eight eggs. Sometimes you're pulling out two. So do you find that they're probably going to do a series of cycles to kind of get to that good embryo?
If you're talking about diminished ovarian reserve in women over 40,
yeah.
No, if anything, you know, you may end up doing less cycles because you're more successful in creating good embryos. The argument that I would make is that the high stimulation protocols are making things worse. You're ruining the egg as opposed to helping the egg. So it's not unusual that, like a case that I presented earlier, one cycle there was nothing. You know, every cycle we are producing embryos that potentially could have been pregnancies. How can we make things a little bit more efficient? How do we, in the past, what would we do in my old center in New York, New Hope Fertility? It was New Hope Fertility in New York City. Dr. John Zhang basically brought Cato's Ladies Clinic, this idea of minimal stimulation to the United States while, you know, we were working to kind of spread this open. What we did in those days, we would just collect bank embryos over and over again. And you know, the hope is that eventually one of those embryos would be successful. But there have been situations where we run through all the embryos, nothing happens. One thing that has changed things in many IVF centers is PGT, pre-implantation genetic testing. You know, how can we prevent ourselves from having to bank dozens and dozens of embryos? Well, we could do PGT. You know, we can test the embryos, see if the embryos are more likely to be normal or less likely to be normal. If we get to the point we find an embryo more likely to be normal, we can stop there. Or we can plan a little bit. We know that two embryos guarantees one child. Maybe the patient's interested in having two kids. You bank your embryo enough to have two children. Another approach would be, everybody's been doing this freeze-all nowadays. You take it the total opposite approach, fresh embryo transfers, transfer these embryos as day three, see if the patient gets pregnant, you know, and focus on making sure that everything else, cleaning out that uterus, everything else optimizes the chance that a good embryo will actually implant. You do increase the risk of miscarriages in those situations, but at the same time, the hope is that you're going to be lucky enough, the 50-50, that you've transferred an embryo that would result in a healthy, normal baby.
Why did you say you would increase the chance of miscarriage?
Oh, because what happens is we know that as women get older, their risk of miscarriage increases because of chromosomally abnormal embryos. So every time you just randomly put an embryo into a woman's body over the age of 40, and they should they get pregnant, 50% or more, that pregnancy is going to be abnormal. They're going to miscarry.
Well, this is if you're not testing for
If you're doing fresh
TGC.
embryo
I
transfer, yeah.
thought it was day three versus day five for some reason. I thought because you mentioned putting it in on a day three fresh, so I was
Yeah.
wondering if that had anything to do with it.
No. I mean, you could also do a fresh day five. I tend not to do fresh day five, fresh blastocyst transfers because many of my patients come from outside the area, and logistically, it makes it difficult because not all embryos are going to make it to blastocyst 5 days. And you kind of don't want to have a patient linger, travel, stay around for an extra week, and find out that there's no embryo good enough to transfer in a situation like that.
Can I ask this? I want to talk about that again. You know, I used to be a CPA, so I have this auditor's brain. So I'm thinking so here's how I'm just going to ask the question, and then I want to hear if you have a different thought for this. So you had mentioned that you'll often do a fresh day three because if they have to stay an extra 2 or 3 days to get it to blastocyst, so day five or six, it may not grow to blastocyst, so you have nothing to transfer. That'd be really disappointing. But we're just putting in the day three, it's still not going to give them a pregnancy. So at the end of the day, it's still unsuccessful because if it wouldn't grow, if your lab is good, and this is what I've heard. I'm the acupuncturist, not an IVF clinic. But if they can't make it to day five, then the thought process is that day three that wouldn't have made it to day five wouldn't have ended up as a live birth.
Yeah.
So some people would like the idea of knowing versus having to take medicine for the next 2 weeks and waiting. So what's your th thought on that?
It's an interesting point with the laboratory. Is the laboratory really as good as the uterus as an incubator? The older there was an old
Well,
an
I would
old
say yes, because on day three, we're putting the embryo in the uterus. And the lab is mimicking the fallopian tube because on day three, the embryo wouldn't be in the uterus, it would be in the fallopian tube. And so, if the
Right.
lab is mimicking the medium of the fallopian tube, then I would think it could be better than the uterus
Yeah.
because the uterus shouldn't have an embryo in it on day three.
Here's another point. Is the laboratory too good? We know a lot of these embryos are actually a mix of normal abnormal cells. As the embryo starts to split, mutations happen. These abnormal cells develop. In the uterus, is it a Darwinian environment? Is are the and then if that's the case, the healthier cells tend to survive, the unhealthy cells tend to die away. In a laboratory environment, if the laboratory perhaps is better than the human body, are you actually supporting these abnormal cells to develop? And are you actually forcing these embryos to become abnormal as opposed to these mosaic embryos? We know that mosaic embryos can result in healthy, normal babies. But are we perhaps forcing these abnormal cells and forcing these embryos into becoming aneuploid cells, embryos, as opposed to letting the abnormal cells die away in the body and self-correct?
Right, that's a good question. I don't know if the embryo itself it's self-correcting if it does it differently in the uterus versus
Yeah.
a lab. I don't know if that data
Yeah.
exists, but
And
yeah.
that's where there's a lot of controversy with PGT. How can we be completely confident with the results from PGT that an abnormal cell, I mean, abnormal embryo has no chance of resulting in a normal, healthy baby? Obviously, we saw with the first generation of NGS a couple, what is it, about 7, 8 years ago, many embryos were not transferred. They were called abnormal, but we realized that many of those embryos would have resulted in healthy, normal babies. The results have gotten much better than that recently, but at the same time, we don't have the data. Right now, the only paper that I've seen, we're talking about maybe 150, 200 embryos that have been transferred in a case like that.
And what you're reminding to our listeners is that we forget that this is technology and we're advancing, but it's not, we're not at the level of God energy, right? That
Yeah.
the people have the expectation, understandably, they want this to work so badly, and there's so much advancements. But at the end of the day, as you're sharing, there's just so many unknown factors still. But the technology has come a long way. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And yet we don't get 100% success, unfortunately.
Right.
We kind of alluded, talked about it a bit, but I thought maybe we just kind of explicitly say, I want to know who the candidates are. And I think I need clarification because I don't know if I'm understanding the terms correctly. Mini IVF and minimal stimulation. To me, that sounds the same, but are those two different procedures or are they the same?
Mini IVF is one protocol. So you kind of say that, you know, you'll hear this thing called an antagonist protocol or a long protocol. So mini IVF is a particular minimal stimulation protocol that applies to a combination of oral medications and injections. That's mini IVF.
And then, and minimal stimulation could be without the oral medication, could just be the injectables at a minimal level.
Yes. Minimal stimulation could apply to natural IVFs as well.
There's no stimulation
there. Yeah. Okay.
All right. So then we're going to use the word minimal stimulation because it encompasses more. So it's lower dose of the FSH type drugs or those lower injectables plus oral ovulation drug like Clomid or letrozole, or just a natural cycle where you go in and do a retrieval. Minimal stimulation. Who are the candidates that you want to educate them and use this approach with? Who are those patients that you see that they could benefit from this regular over the traditional IVF in general?
Let's just take a person who's perfectly healthy. They don't have an issue of age or diminished ovarian reserve. But let's say that we have a person whose tubes are blocked. You know, we know that the egg quality is probably fine. Tubal ligation, you know, a person with a tubal ligation finds themselves in another relationship, you know, untying the tubes is not necessarily 100% effective to reconnect those tubes again. Minimal stimulation might be a good option where you just take some oral medication. We have something called a low complexity IVF cycle where you take some oral medications for 5 days, 1 or 2 days of injection, 2 or 3, you get 2 or 4 eggs created, you create those embryos. And then I usually just put them back as a fresh embryo transfer at some point, usually day 2, day 3. And that could be a candidate where they're technically not infertile. They just have some sort of blockage in their tubes or maybe a lesbian couple, same sex couple in the situation like that. The patients are not necessarily infertile. Maybe the IUIs have not been successful, then a low stimulation protocol might make a lot of sense in a situation like that.
And can you clarify why? Because in these two groups, age or egg quality doesn't seem to be an issue. So the question is, why not do a traditional and get a lot of embryos because we're not worried about the high FSH maybe damaging their eggs? And why put it in fresh on day 2 or 3? Why not grow them out to blast for that group?
Well, medications, you know, I guess you're in Canada, but in the United States, medications can basically be the cost of the IVF cycle. You know, you're doubling the cost. We can reduce the cost of medication to, you know, $500, you know, even less if you're just doing oral medications. Another thing that you can do, which we routinely do here at our center, 80 to 90% of my egg retrievals are done under local anesthesia. You know, if you have 20 or 30 eggs to retrieve, it could be done. I've retrieved 35, 40 eggs under local anesthesia, but it's difficult and the patients have to be very motivated. 2 or 3 eggs, I mean, that takes me no more than, you know, 5 minutes. These patients don't have to starve themselves. They can drive to work if they want to right after the retrieval. There's no cost for the anesthesia. There's no anesthesia risk. You know, by the time the patients are asleep under sedation, I can be done with the egg retrieval by that time. So there's cost benefits and efficiency benefits associated with it.
So the efficiency and the cost, but are we sacrificing success? Because at the end of the day, if somebody's going to have an increase in a live birth rate, a lot of them would be happier to have the inconvenience of not being able to drive or the expense versus not the success. So
then you talk about the embryos that you have left over. You've created maybe 5, 6 embryos. Your intention is to only have one child. First embryo transfer is successful. What do you do with those extra embryos?
Right. There's always those dilemmas, isn't there? Yeah. You're right. And then sometimes people don't get pregnant the first try. So they only have one. then they don't. So
but that's where patient selection. You're talking about patients who are not necessarily in their egg quality is fine, sperm quality is fine. It's a patient selection issue.
Right.
So another scenario would be.
I wasn't expecting you to share like the same sex group or somebody who had blocked tubes. I was wondering your candidates, are these people that are older, they have a diagnosis of a diminished ovarian reserve, or they've been through multiple failed IVF. So I was thinking kind of, that's how I would predict would be your population for this.
Oh, and, my specific population, you're right. My specific practice is diminished ovarian reserve, high FSH, patients who failed multiple IVF cycles, doing it one way.
Right.
You know, the idea is to try it a different way. For my patients, you know, with the diminished ovarian reserve, typically I would want them to have a period on a regular basis. You know, once you start getting very irregular periods where you're only cycling every other month, every third month, the diminished ovarian reserve, you know, it's getting into that POI, premature ovarian insufficiency. Mm-hmm. It can start get very, very difficult at that point. But the age makes a huge difference. If I have a patient who's very irregular, the AMH is very, very poor, ovarian reserve is very poor. If they're 33, I have a chance there, you know. But if I have a patient with a very irregular cycle and a poor FSH and they're 43, the likelihood is very, very low. Even in a situation like that, I might discourage them from pursuing this. Although I know that I can at least give them an opportunity. And for some patients, all they want is that one opportunity before they say, well, maybe we should give up and head over to egg donation or adoption.
So with this population that you're seeing then, you mentioned you want them to be cycling regular. And, you know, when you start to get into the age group of the 40s, I'm curious if your clinic does this based on your, because it sounds like your patient population, a big focus is diminished ovarian reserve, multiple failed IVFs, and over 40. Are you also doing like PRP and growth factors injections? That's something you do in your clinic? I'm just curious because I'm just starting to hear more about that. And we've had a couple of podcast episodes on that.
Yes. You know, it just makes sense in these situations. So we did work, we're working with a Dr. Pantos from the Genesis Clinic in Greece. Okay. They were kind of the ones who pioneered all this. So we're working with them and we do platelet-rich plasma. I used to have to refer them all the way to, you know, my patients all the way to Greece to do this, but it just made sense. A lot of my patients were asking about it. So we just started our own program and we decided to partner with the people who started it. You know, so we do that. I will counsel my patients on some experimental procedures, you know, heading over to the ED clinic in Spain for bone marrow stem cell therapy, or thinking about in vitro activation where you're taking out portions of the ovary and treating those in various growth hormones in the culture media, and then reimplanting that ovarian tissue into the body. I don't do them myself, but I think it's my obligation from the patient population that I have to talk about these procedures.
Yeah, there's so many things happening, and it's nice that you let them know about those resources. And I'm just curious to see where it's going to go next. Having observed it since early 2000, it's been pretty an amazing ride to see how much the technology has advanced. Going back to this holistic approach and just in the integration, are you working, is this part of also kind of what you look into? Do you work with other allied health professionals with respect to the acupuncture, supplements, meditation, Chinese herbal medicine? Is that something that you like for this population as well? Do you have experience with that?
Yeah, I think that in a portion of this population, there's a lot of depletion of their natural energy or the natural minerals in this group. I think what you guys do is so extensive. There's no way that I have any, I can be a professional in what you do, you know, because I'm already working too hard as it is. So this is where I'm working with like your colleague, Dr. Mark Sklar. I work with a lot of the acupuncturists. Instead of saying, oh, I'm going to have you take these nutrients, which I don't know how much research I've done. You know, I'd rather just send them to a professional, someone who really knows what they're doing, go to the specialist. And that's where I depend on you and your colleagues to try to make sure my patient is overall healthy, you know, because that's going to, that will have a dramatic impact on what I can do for them.
Yeah, it's nice, that integration. And again, at the time of this recording, integration has really come a long way. When I started, it was really difficult to work with IVF clinics. And through perseverance, now we have this integration where, you know, we're referring patients to the clinics for these workups and these procedures like you're doing. And then they're referring them to us for stress reduction, diet, the right supplements, acupuncture, herbal medicine. So it's nice at this time that patients now have the left and right hand talking together. Before, patients would keep it a secret when they saw me. Now they're like, I'm doing this. Or you're saying, yeah, do the acupuncture while we do this. So it's nice.
And what's nice in California, the scope of practice for acupuncturists or naturopaths is much bigger than a lot of other states or countries, which is nice. So the patients who are not quite ready to see an REI, not quite ready to bring it to talk about this with a Western physician, which is basically, I have a little bladder irritation. It might be an early infection. You go into your doctor, they're going to be doing these tests and cultures and immediately putting you on high dose antibiotics. There's another step in the process. You know, you can go to your acupuncturist, you can go to your naturopath. They might be able to kind of find some more holistic approach, more natural approach, and may avoid having to go through a lot of extensive testing and very invasive procedures.
And can people, if they're from outside of the United States, and we have listeners from all over the world, so obviously in the States, but outside, can they contact you to do a consult? Do you do those?
Yes, we actually have, I've treated patients, actually we have a number of patients from Germany. I don't know why Germany, but a group of patients, a lot of patients from Germany. I get patients from Canada all the time. A lot of from Asia, especially because of our connection with our mother center in Kobe, Japan. So patients do reach out. I do, with the diminished ovarian reserve, it is especially the more difficult ones where the patients are not ovulating on a regular basis. It's difficult when you're more than three time zones away, you know. So I've had, just logistically, it just becomes so difficult. A patient in that situation, it's not as simple, I give you a treatment, I'm expecting in 2 weeks to do an egg retrieval. You know, this is sometimes I'm treating you, I'm trying to make sure that the hormones are ideal, I'm waiting for a response. This could be 2 months, 3 months. And then suddenly at the very last moment, oh, I need to have you fly here to the United States so we could do an egg retrieval in 48 hours. So it's not ideal. I'd much rather train doctors and teach doctors this. But once again, you know, there is a little bit of a blowback, you know, right now from the conventional REIs about minimal stimulation.
Okay. So if our listeners want to connect with you, they can go to your website, hannahbusaivf.com, and we'll put that in the show notes. So there's videos there, by the way, where they summarize their approach to the mini IVF, and they also have videos and information on their diminished ovarian reserve and how it works with their mini IVF for those that are interested. And you can also follow the clinic on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and LinkedIn. And we'll put all that in the show notes so people can find a way to connect with you and learn a little bit more about this approach to helping them have a baby with their own eggs for where they've haven't had success thus far. So thank you for your time, Dr. Chung. I really appreciate you letting me pepper you with questions and clarify things. I really appreciate your patience and coming on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This is very fun, and I'm very open to all these questions. It's always interesting, and the most important thing is just educating the patient so they understand that there are options out there.
Yeah, there's options out there. Thank you very much.
If you're looking for support to grow your family, contact AccuBalance Wellness Center. At AccuBalance, they help you reach your peak fertility potential through their integrative approach using low-level laser therapy, fertility acupuncture, and naturopathic medicine. Download the AccuBalance Fertility Diet and Dr. Brown's video for mastering manifestation and clearing subconscious blocks. go to acubalance.ca. That's acubalance.ca.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Conscious Fertility, the show that helps you receive life on purpose. Please take a moment to subscribe to the show and join the community of women and men on their path to peak fertility and choosing to live consciously on purpose. I would love to continue this conversation with you, so please direct message me on Instagram at Lauren Brown Official. That's Instagram, Lauren Brown Official. Or you can visit my websites, laurenbrown.com and acubalance.ca. Until the next episode, stay curious, and for a few moments, bring your awareness to your heart center and breathe.